Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 20th, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call as today we discuss today's U.S. Supreme Court decision in the RJR Nabisco RICO case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and as always, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to Teleforum Corey L. Andrews. He's Senior Litigation Counsel at Washington Legal Foundation. They did file a brief in the case, and he's going to give us some background on the case and then talk about today's decision and maybe its implications going forward. With that, Mr. Andrews, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and it's always a pleasure to be with the Federalist Society. This is a case that I think the business community in particular has been watching for a while. The court was asked to decide whether the federal racketeering statute, RICO, applies extraterritorially outside the United States, and if so, what does that mean? To what extent does it apply? It's kind of an unusual case in that it's been litigated for 15 years now, and it actually never got past the motion to dismiss. It's had evolving allegations along the way. Essentially, the latest allegations claim that far-flung conspiracy of drug dealers laundered money, and one of the ways they laundered money was by purchasing cigarettes, and they did this in the EU markets. And so the EU nations allege that the cigarette manufacturers were complicit in this money laundering and that injured their sovereign country's interests because it injured their competition as they also sell cigarettes. So it's a case that's never – no evidence has been seen, no discovery has been had. It's really in many ways a poster child for sort of the way civil RICO has been able to be used. And so other than RJR, every other cigarette manufacturer was named in the suit settled. And I think the settlement sum is approaching $2 billion, which is pretty good work if you can get it. So in a lot of ways, this is a simple case. I think it's just superficially complicated because RICO is superficially complicated. The RICO statute has a substantive criminal prohibition. That's section 1962. And that makes it illegal to engage in a pattern of racketeering in connection with an enterprise. And so you have a pattern of racketeering and an enterprise. Those are the concepts under the statute's criminal provision. A pattern is any two or more criminal acts within a 10-year period that are related. An enterprise is either a corporation or really any association in fact, which is what was alleged here in some respects. In a separate provision, entirely separate provision, section 1964, there is a private right of action that we know as civil RICO that allows a plaintiff to recover for injuries to their business or property that were caused by virtue of a violation of the substantive criminal prohibition. So with that in mind, the court has sort of, in both the Morrison Australia Bank case and in the Kiobel case, has talked a lot about a canon of statutory construction that we call the presumption against extraterritoriality. And so that canon says, absent clearly expressed congressional intent to the contrary, federal law will be construed to have only domestic application. Congress is understood to have domestic concerns in mind. So in bringing that canon to apply in RICO, the court reminded everyone that it's a two-step framework, that first you have to ask whether the presumption against extraterritoriality has been rebutted somewhere within the statute. And that's something that it didn't have to really do in Morrison or Kiobel, or didn't seem to be much of an issue because those statutes gave no indication that they had extraterritorial reach. And so if and only if you satisfy that step, then you go on to look at the focus of the statute. And so much of the briefing and some of a good bit of the oral argument was about the focus of the statute, whether it's racketeering prohibitions were focused at overseas conduct. The court doesn't even really get to step two because it says if you look at the statutes themselves, particularly the section 1962, that they see an indication there that there is extraterritorial application. They derive that from the RICO predicate statutes, the litany of federal crimes that serve as a predicate under RICO. And so if you look at some of those, it's clear that they definitely have extraterritorial reach. The court lists a few, such as the prohibition against assassinating a government official, for example, or the prohibition against hostage taking. One of the provisions seems to can only be applied extraterritorially. It's prohibiting the murder or assassination of a U.S. citizen abroad. So those are the federal predicates. Those are statutes that are on the books. They're not technically a part of RICO, but they're incorporated into RICO. And so the court says we want to look at the context overall. We don't just want to look at the Section 1962 language. We want to look at it in context. And in context, these predicate acts tell us that, you know what, as long as the predicate crime has an extraterritorial reach, then we think Section 1962, the criminal prohibition, also has an extraterritorial reach. And so that was actually what the Second Circuit held. And so a lot of the opinion is agreeing with the Second Circuit on that point. And this turns out to be a 4-3 opinion. Justice Sotomayor was recused, and the entire court signs on to the first three sections of the opinion, which governs sort of the reach of this substantive prohibition. Where the court starts to part company is when it gets to the civil RICO provision under 1964, which is really what this case is all about. And so there the court looks at the civil RICO provision and it sees no indication whatsoever in looking at that provision that there was any intention on the part of Congress to allow for compensation for injuries that occurred abroad. The government in this case filed an amicus curiae brief essentially making the same exact argument positions that the court ended up adopting. The government said, we think there are serious problems with applying civil RICO abroad, including interfering with international comedy, but we think we should be able to secure the interests of the United States in enforcing federal law in a criminal setting when the predicate acts themselves apply extraterritorially. And so at the end of the day, that's what the court ended up doing. So Section 1964 requires a plaintiff to allege and prove a domestic injury to business or property and does not allow for recovery of foreign injuries. That's the big takeaway holding from this case. As a result, the court remanded the case and basically said it needed to be dismissed because there was no way. In fact, I think the plaintiffs in this case waived the existence of any domestic injury. So that should end this litigation. The dissent was Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, and essentially they would have just affirmed the Second Circuit. They thought that the Second Circuit's reasoning made more sense. There is a kind of logical, beauty to it because they say, well, for the same reasons that context matters with regard to the criminal prohibition, it should also matter with the civil prohibition, the civil remedy as well. So there was an argument by the plaintiffs that, it's silly to take concerns of international comedy into concern because in this case we have actual foreign sovereigns who are the plaintiffs. So don't hang your hat on that. And the court made clear, Justice Alito, in his majority opinion, made clear that we, when we interpret the statute, we have to interpret it for all instances and for all plaintiffs, not just, you know, we can't just have a one-off when a foreign sovereign is a plaintiff. The statute means what the statute means, and it means it no matter who the plaintiff is that happens to bring the suit. So this decision is going to put an end to, you know, the plaintiff's bar effort that we've seen since, really since RICO was enacted in 1970, to use civil RICO as a means of compelling settlements for claims for conduct that occurs overseas. One of the concerns that people had raised in the wake of Kiobel, which limited, severely cut back the use of the Alien Tort Statute, was that civil RICO would be seen as an opportunity or a surrogate to pivot to in place of the Alien Tort Statute. And we actually, there were in our brief, we cite some examples of where this is happening, and even some law review articles where people are saying you should do this. And this will put an end to that as well. So that the numbers of statutes that are allowing for U.S. companies that do business abroad to be hailed into U.S. courts for conduct abroad has been, you know, properly cabined once again in this case. And with that, I will turn it back over to Dean and take any questions you may have.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Let's open it up to the audience for questions in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see who rings in. Let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll discuss another case decided by the court today. That's the Quozo case. It's a property rights patent case arising under the America Invents Act. That's tomorrow at 1. On Wednesday at noon Eastern Time, both of these are Eastern Time, our topic will be secession and Brexit, with an eye to Brexit on the eve of Britain's vote. That's Wednesday at noon Eastern Time. Thursday, of course, today the court announced that Thursday will be yet another decision day for the court, so we will very likely host a teleforum on Thursday on one or more opinions to be announced on Thursday. And for Friday, as of now, we have a teleforum scheduled on Friday looking at the Department of Labor's new overtime rules. Today, of course, we're talking about the RJR Nabisco case with Corey Andrews. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask the first question to get us started here. In our sort of preamble call or our pre-call, you mentioned that you weren't really particularly surprised that, and I think you even mentioned in your opening comments, it's a somewhat straightforward case with a somewhat complicated statute underlying it. I wonder if you wanted to say more about some of the settlement pressures that arise under RICO, the treble damages, I think just some the optics around being sued under RICO, the notion of conspiracy, racketeering, all those things that arise, which sometimes don't obtain in these cases, and what that means for defendants, along with treble damages.
Sure. I mean, you pointed to one of them. The treble damages remedy itself gives plaintiffs an enormous amount of leverage to exact a settlement. And even what, you know, the defendant, you know, knows to be a frivolous case. But I think the added leverage in these kind of settlements comes from the being branded in, you know, the media and the newspaper as the minute that a complaint is filed in which your company is accused of a racketeering or criminal enterprise or anything like that, there becomes a very quick interest in resolving the dispute and making it go away as fast as you possibly can, which, again, this case is a perfect poster child for that type of abuse. You know, as I said, I believe Greg Katz at Jones Day would know the latest numbers, but I think it's approaching $2 billion in settlements for every other major manufacturer of cigarettes that was on the market in Europe at the time. And RJR Nabisco said, we're not going to do it. And they decided to fight. And sometimes that's what it takes, is for companies to take a strong stand. And in this case, it ended up being, you know, being the right thing not only for them, but for all their competitors too, who will benefit from today's ruling.
Again, if you are in the audience, have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask another question. If you want to say more about the impact of this going forward, and then if you know, are there other cases in the pipeline? Are there other businesses, big or small, that are contesting some sort of RICO action that might further narrow its application going forward?
Well, I mean, I think going forward, just in terms of the generic impact, I mean, this is another decision in the direction of cabining liability, as of drawing a line and say no further. There was a broad consensus that RICO, civil RICO in particular, had gotten so out of whack and so out of control, because it's such an elastic statute, that something needed to be done, and this will certainly help do that. It also continues the court's important trend of shying away from extraterritorial application of U.S. law, as we've seen now, you know, earlier in Morrison and Kiobel. But most importantly, it deprives the plaintiff's bar of the ability to extract these huge settlements over frivolous RICO claims allegedly based on foreign conduct, because a lot of times the company is just eager to avoid the reputational hit of being branded a racketeer. In terms of other suits where this may be applicable, in terms of other RICO suits, I'm not aware of any, although I think, you know, many of us have heard of the investigations that are taking place by various state attorneys general of the energy industry and some of the energy industry's allies. And so to the extent that any of those investigations involve activities that were overseas relating to, I believe it's climate change, you know, this may have some modest effect of paring down the scope of whatever actions may ultimately come out of that whole effort. So,
once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have a question from our audience, and then our lines once again will be wide open. Now we've got a second question, so let's take our first call of the day. Caller, if you have your own telephone on mute, you need to come off mute.
Hello, Corey. This is John Chu in California. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, hi, John. Sure.
My question is about if there's any further room for narrowing or parsing in terms of RICO actions that start overseas. In other words, in this case, in the RJR case, the alleged actions of RJR were pretty much clearly overseas. But a lot of companies are so tightly interwoven in terms of their home bases or their operational bases or their tax bases being in overseas countries. I'm wondering if there's any further room for parsing for another foreign activity RICO case to come forward.
Sure. Great question. And we know of this tendency to, you know, refine and revisit the issues based on what has happened in the wake of the Kiobel decision and the Alien Tort Statute. You know, that didn't end the litigation the next day. There were lots of efforts to chip away at that precedent, you know, litigating over various, you know, nuances in the opinion. Here, in this case, I think where you're most likely to see that kind of effort play out is on the predicate crimes themselves. So the court has issued a very bright line rule that says unless the predicate RICO crime that you're alleging as part of the racketeering activity, unless that itself applies extraterritorially, then you can't use RICO extraterritorially. And again, that's for I'm speaking now about the government's use of it. As far as civil RICO goes, even in those cases where the court makes clear, even in those cases where the predicate is extraterritorial in scope, that civil remedy is just not available. So it's a very robust holding in that way. I would feel better if it was more than a 4-3 holding, which is what it is, and therefore a future court composed of 5 people may decide they want to revisit the holding. But in terms of the civil aspect, I feel like it's a pretty bright line rule. The criminal component of it is remains open. This wasn't a criminal case. I think the clear implication from the court's holding is that the government is able to bring criminal actions for extraterritorial conduct where the predicate crimes themselves attach extraterritorially. But I think there may be some further refining in that area once those sorts of criminal cases come down the pipe.
Do you see any application of the RJR case to the ongoing Chevron RICO, civil RICO suit against the plaintiff's firm and the people in South America?
I have to go back and look at that case. I don't remember what the allegations are, but if that is a civil RICO case?
Civil RICO with alleged bribery, wire fraud, et cetera, but commencing in South America.
Commencing in South America, yeah. I think this holding definitely makes the plaintiff's job very, very difficult in that case, and should in all likelihood dispose of the case.
Thank you.
We had one question pending that dropped, so our lines are wide open once again. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we wait to see if somebody else rings in, let me ask you about the recusal. You mentioned Justice Sotomayor was recused. Did she give a reason for that, or can we assume that she was involved as a judge in the Second Circuit?
That's right. They almost never give a reason for the recusal, but it's almost certainly because she was a judge in the Second Circuit. And as I said, this case has been kicking around the Second Circuit for 15 years before it came to the court. So I'm almost positive that was her reason for recusal.
Very good. Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have another question, so let's head to our next caller.
Hi, this is Chris Bowen. How, if at all, was the decision affected by the earlier Supreme Court decision regarding the Foreign Trade Antitrust Improvements Act?
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure that it was. I don't recall seeing that issue come up. Is that, unless, are you referring to the Clayton Act or?
No, it was there was 1982 Foreign Trade Antitrust Improvements Act, and plaintiffs had used that act to try and bring claims in the United States courts alleging overseas conspiracies. I believe it was a decision about 10 years ago. I believe it was Empagram, but I could be wrong on that.
That's right, yeah.
And
yeah. I remember the Empagram decision. So that was the first decision in what's now a long line of decisions cutting back on extraterritoriality. The statutes are completely different, so I don't know that it was influenced in that regard, but the rule that was announced, the general rule that statutes are presumed not to apply to overseas conduct unless Congress explicitly says so, that started more or less in the Empagram case, in the modern era, and has continued through Morrison and Kiobel and now RJR. So it was an important part of the precedent here, just in terms of setting up a long line of decisions enforcing territorial reach of U.S. courts.
If you had to guess where plaintiffs seeking damages for overseas conduct would go next in terms of which statute they'd look to, would you have any guesses?
I don't want to give them any good ideas. but honestly, I'm not sure where things are going in that regard. I don't think, certainly, there's no permanent victory in the war against bad ideas, and I know that there will be other statutes that are tested and tried. Not wanting to give me bad ideas, and because off the top of my head, I'm at a loss to think of one that seems especially prone to this kind of abuse. I guess I don't have a good answer for you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Let me make a second final call for questions. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Corey Andrews, I think we've exhausted the audience's questions for today on this case. Let me give you a few minutes to wrap up. Express a final thought if you have one here.
Sure. Today's decision on RJR continues a clear trend on the part of the court to cabin the reach of federal statutes to domestic concerns unless Congress expressly states an intention to do otherwise. And so in so doing, it puts an end to efforts to tag sort of foreign domestic companies with civil RICO suits for overseas conduct. And it also ensures that RICO will not now supplant the Alien Tort Statute as the plaintiff's sort of go-to statute, with treble damages and attorney's fees provisions, which are very attractive, in order to sue for foreign conduct. So that should have a salutary effect on the litigation climate in the United States.
Well, my thanks to Corey Andrews. He's senior counsel, litigation counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. We certainly appreciate your thoughts today, especially on such short notice. Reminder to our audience, and thank you to our audience for dialing in as well and for your questions. Our next scheduled teleforum conference calls tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be discussing another case decided today by the court. That's the Cuozzo patent case. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.